Chapter 2. The Future of the United States. Is the United States in systemic decline? What are America's primary strengths? What worries you about the U.S. government? What worries you about U.S. culture? Does effective governance require guardians? Is the United States at risk of becoming European? What does the U.S. need to do to maintain global primacy? In this chapter, Lee Kuan Yew draws on his long experience with the United States to offer perceptive and provocative answers to these questions. Is the United States in systemic decline?
Absolutely not. The U.S. is going through a bumpy patch with its debt and deficits. But I have no doubt that America will not be reduced to second-rate status. Historically, the U.S. has demonstrated a great capacity for renewal and revival. America's strengths include no groove thinking, but rather an ability to range widely, imaginatively, and pragmatically. A diversity of centers of excellence that compete in inventing and embracing new ideas and new technologies. A society that attracts talent from around the world and assimilates them comfortably as Americans, and a language that is the equivalent of an open system that is clearly the lingua franca of the leaders in science, technology, invention, business, education, diplomacy, and those who rise to the top of their societies around the world. Although America is currently facing tremendously difficult economic times, America's creativity, resilience, and innovative spirit will allow it to confront its core problems, overcome them, and regain competitiveness. For the next 2 to 3 decades, America will remain the sole superpower. The U.S. is the most militarily powerful and economically dynamic country in the world. It is the engine for global growth through its innovation, productivity, and consumption. Today and for the next few decades, it is the U.S. that will be preeminent in setting the rules of the game. No major issue concerning international peace and stability can be resolved without U.S. leadership, and no country or grouping can yet replace America as the dominant global power. The U.S. response to the terrorist attacks of 9/11 demonstrated America's preeminence. That shock altered the attitudes of Americans on how to deal with terrorist threats to their society. Washington did not hesitate to use its enormous power to change the rules of the game to hunt down and destroy terrorists and those who give them succor. For the next few decades, the U.S. will be a virtual American empire. Whether you are African or South American or Indian or Filipino or Chinese or Korean, Americans will let you work for them in America and in their multinational corporations abroad. Throughout history, all empires that succeeded have embraced and included in their midst people of other races, languages, religions, and cultures. For the next 10, 15, 20 years, the U.S. will remain the most enterprising, innovative economy because of its leading-edge technology, both in the civilian and military fields. You will lose that gradually over 30, 40, 50 years unless you are able to keep on attracting talent, and that is the final contest, because the Chinese and other nations are going to adopt parts of what you have done to fit their circumstances, and they are also going around looking for talented people and building up their innovative, enterprising economies. And finally, this is now an age when you will not have military contests between great nations, because you will destroy each other. But you will have economic and technological contests between the great powers.
What are America's primary strengths?
Americans have a can-do approach to life. Everything can be broken up, analyzed, and redefined. Whether it can or it cannot, Americans believe it can be solved, given enough money, research, and effort. Over the years, I have watched the Americans revise and restructure their economy. After they were going down in the 1980s, when Japan and Germany looked like they were eclipsing America, taking over all the manufacturing, Americans came roaring back. They have the superior system. It is more competitive. What has made the U.S. economy preeminent is its entrepreneurial culture. Entrepreneurs and investors alike see risk and failure as natural and necessary for success. When they fail, they pick themselves up and start afresh. The Europeans and the Japanese now have the task of adopting these practices to increase their efficiency and competitiveness. But many American practices go against the grain of the more comfortable and communitarian cultural systems of their own societies. The Japanese, with lifelong employment for their workers. The Germans, with their unions having a say in management under co-determination. And the French, with their government supporting the right of unions to pressure businesses for retrenching by requiring large compensation to be paid to laid-off workers. The U.S. is a frontier society. There is a great urge to start new enterprises and create wealth. The U.S. has been the most dynamic society in innovating, in starting up companies to commercialize new discoveries or inventions, thus creating new wealth. American society is always on the move and changing. For every successful entrepreneur in America, many have tried and failed. Quite a few tried repeatedly until they succeeded. Quite a few succeeded to continue to create and start up new companies as serial entrepreneurs. This is the spirit that generates a dynamic economy. The American culture is that we start from scratch and beat you. That is why I have confidence that the American economy will recover. They were going down against Japan and Germany in manufacturing, but they came up with the Internet, Microsoft, and Bill Gates, and Dell. What kind of mindset do you need for that? It is part of their history. They went into an empty continent and made the best of it, killed the Red Indians, and took over the land and the buffaloes. So this is how they ended up. You build a town here, you be the sheriff, I am the judge, you are the policeman, and you are the banker. Let us start. And this culture has carried on until today. There is the belief that you can make it happen. The Americans have succeeded against the Europeans and the Japanese because they have more extremes of random behavior. You have the mean, you have the bell curve, and you have two extreme ends. And the more you have of the extreme ends on the good side, the more creativity and inventiveness you have. One fundamental difference between American and Oriental culture is the individual's position in society. In American culture, an individual's interest is primary. This makes American society more aggressively competitive, with a sharper edge and higher performance. The Americans will always have the advantage because of their all-embracive society, and the English language that makes it easy to attract foreign talent. America has a clear advantage over China because its use of the English language enables America to attract millions of English-speaking foreign talent from Asia and Europe. There is an off chance that the United States will lose confidence in itself, will not be so creative, so inventive, and creating breakthroughs in new technologies, and not attracting new talents from abroad. I do not see the United States in the next 10, 20, 30 years losing that capability. Talent will not go to China. Talent will go to America because Americans speak English and everybody fits in. It is a country that embraces immigrants. To go and settle in China, you have to master the Chinese language, and you must get used to the Chinese culture, and that is a very difficult hurdle to clear. The U.S. is the only superpower because of its advances in science and technology and their contribution to its economic and military might. The U.S. dollar is likely to remain the leading currency because the American economy will remain the most entrepreneurial and dynamic in the world. America is a great nation not just because of its power and wealth, but mainly because it is a nation moved by high ideals. Only the elevating power of her idealism can explain the benign manner in which America has exercised its enormous power since the end of World War II, and the magnanimity and generosity with which it has shared its wealth to rebuild a more prosperous world. The United States is the most benign of all the great powers, certainly less heavy-handed than any emerging great power. As long as its economy leads the world and America stays ahead in innovation and technology, neither the European Union nor Japan nor China can displace the United States from its present preeminent position.
What worries you about the U.S. government?
When you have popular democracy, to win votes, you have to give more and more. And to beat your opponent in the next election, you have to promise to give more away. So it is a never-ending process of auctions, and the costs, the debt being paid for by the next generation. Presidents do not get re-elected if they give a hard dose of medicine to their people. So there is a tendency to procrastinate, to postpone unpopular policies in order to win elections. So problems such as budget deficits, debt, and high unemployment have been carried forward from one administration to the next. If the president and the Congress are conscribed by popular sentiment, then they will always be captive. America must have leaders who are prepared to lead and know what is good for America and do it, even if they lose their re-election. A system of governance that does not allow them to do a quiet U-turn when they identify problems is malfunctioning. A certain coyness or diffidence seems to have descended upon American politicians. American academics and journalists freely discuss America's problems and weaknesses. But in the years since the Vietnam War ended, the American voter has shown a disinclination to listen to their political leaders when they debate the hard issues. Perhaps for this reason, neither the Republican nor the Democratic Party has focused on the urgent need to cut down deficit spending, especially on welfare, to increase savings and investments, or, most crucial of all, to improve America's school system to produce workers who are able to compete internationally. The presidential system is less likely to produce good government than a parliamentary system. In the presidential system, your personal appearance on TV is decisive, whereas in a parliamentary system, the prime minister, before he becomes the prime minister, has been a member of parliament and probably a minister, and in Britain the people have sized you up over a period of time, and they have come to certain conclusions as to what kind of a person you are, what kind of depth you have, what kind of sincerity you have in what you say. Your presidents, I mean like Jimmy Carter. My name is Jimmy Carter. I am a peanut farmer. I am running for president. The next thing you know, he was the president. Security, prosperity, and the consumer society plus mass communications have made for a different kind of person getting elected as leader. One who can present himself and his programs in a polished way. I am amazed at the way media professionals can give a candidate a new image and transform him, at least superficially, into a different personality. Winning an election becomes, in large measure, a contest in packaging and advertising. A spin doctor is a high-income professional, one in great demand. From such a process, I doubt if a Churchill, a Roosevelt, or a De Gaulle can emerge. Contrary to what American political commentators say, I do not believe that democracy necessarily leads to development. I believe that what a country needs to develop is discipline more than democracy. The exuberance of democracy leads to undisciplined and disorderly conditions which are inimical to development. The ultimate test of the value of a political system is whether it helps that society to establish conditions which improve the standard of living for the majority of its people, thus enabling the maximum of personal freedoms compatible with the freedoms of others in society. One problem is the Philippines has an American-style constitution, one of the most difficult to operate in the world. There is a complete separation of powers between the executive, legislature, and judiciary. But a developing country faced with disorder and underdevelopment needs a strong, honest government. I do not believe that Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, or Singapore could have succeeded if they had to work under such a constitution, where gridlock on every major issue is a way of life. And you will notice that since the Vietnam War and the Great Society, The U.S. system has not functioned even for the United States. Americans seem to think that Asia is like a movie and that you can freeze developments out here whenever the U.S. becomes intensely involved elsewhere in the world. It does not work like that. If the United States wants to substantially affect the strategic evolution of Asia, it cannot come and go. I would like to believe that you can discern your interests dispassionately, as not to have the pendulum swing away from Asia because of your rather tiresome experiences in Vietnam. I accept the world as I find it. One thing I find is the disillusionment of the American people against the losses they have sustained.
What worries you about U.S. culture?
I find parts of it totally unacceptable. Guns, drugs, violent crime, vagrancy, unbecoming behavior in public, and some, the breakdown of civil society. The expansion of the right of the individual to behave or misbehave as he or she pleases has come at the expense of orderly society. It has a lot to do with the erosion of the moral underpinnings of a society and the diminution of personal responsibility. The liberal intellectual tradition that developed after World War II claimed that human beings had arrived at this perfect state where everybody would be better off if they were allowed to do their own thing and flourish. It has not worked out, and I doubt if it will. There's already a backlash in America against failed social policies that have resulted in people urinating in public, in aggressive begging in the streets, in social breakdown. You must have order in society. Guns, drugs, and violent crime all go together, threatening social order. The ideas of individual supremacy, when carried to excess, have not worked. They have made it difficult to keep American society cohesive. Asia can see it is not working. Those who want a wholesome society where young girls and old ladies can walk in the streets at night, where the young are not preyed upon by drug peddlers, will not follow the American model. The top 3 to 5% of a society can handle this free-for-all, this clash of ideas. If you do this with a whole mass, you will have a mess. To have day-to-day images of violence and raw sex on the picture tube, the whole society exposed to it, it will ruin a whole community. When Asians visit the U.S., many are puzzled and disturbed by conditions there. Law and order out of control, with riots, drugs, guns, muggings, rape and crimes, poverty in the midst of great wealth, excessive rights of the individual at the expense of the community as a whole. And criminals regularly escape punishment because the law, which presumes innocence, overprotects their human rights. In the U.S., the community's interests have been sacrificed because of the human rights of drug traffickers and drug consumers. Drug-related crimes flourish. Schools are infected. There is a high delinquency and violence among students, a high dropout rate, poor discipline and teaching, producing students who make poor workers. So a vicious cycle is set in. I do not believe that if you are libertarian, full of diverse opinions, full of competing ideas in the marketplace, full of sound and fury, therefore you will succeed. America's sense of cultural supremacy is again evident when the American media praises Taiwan, Korea, the Philippines, or Thailand for becoming democratic and having a free press. It is praise with condescension. Compliments from a superior culture, patting an inferior one on the head. And it is this same sense of cultural supremacy which leads the American media to pick on Singapore and beat us up as authoritarian, dictatorial, an overruled, over-restricted, stifling, sterile society. Why? Because we have not complied with their ideas of how we should govern ourselves. But we can ill afford to let others experiment with our lives. Their ideas are theories. Theories are not proven. Not proven in East Asia, not even in the Philippines, after they had governed the Philippines for 50 years. Nor are they proven as yet in Taiwan, or Thailand, or Korea. Multiculturalism will destroy America. There's a danger that large numbers of Mexicans and others from South and Central America will continue to come to the U.S. and spread their culture across the whole of the country. If they breed faster than the WASPs, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, and are living with them, whose culture will prevail? Will the WASPs change them, or will the immigrants change the existing culture? They will change each other, but it will be sad for American culture to be changed even partially. Long-term for America, if you project another 100 years, 150 years into the 22nd century, whether you stay on top depends upon the kind of society you will be. Because if the present trends continue, you will have a Hispanic element in your society that is about 30-40%. So, the question is, do you make the Hispanics Anglo-Saxons in culture, or do they make you more Latin American in culture? If they come in drips and drabs and you scatter them across America, then you will have changed their culture. But if they come in large numbers, like Miami, and they stay together, or in California, then their culture will continue and they may well affect the Anglo-Saxon culture around them. That is the real test. I do not describe to the American or British style of politicking. I am not sure in Europe today whether they dig into your family affairs, but in America, they do. So they play up Michelle Obama, the children, the dogs, and so on. Maybe it gives them a better sense of the family. But how does that help them in deciding whether Obama is a good president or whether he is concentrating on the right things to get the economy going?
Does effective governance require guardians?
For Singapore, the basic challenge remains unchanged. Unless we have a steady stream of high-quality people to serve as PM, Prime Minister, and ministers, Singapore, as a little red dot, will become a little black spot. To find able and committed people of integrity, willing to spend the prime of their lives and going through the risky process of elections, we cannot underpay our ministers and argue that their sole reward should be their contribution to the public good. We did not bring Singapore from the third to the first world by headhunting ministers willing to sacrifice their children's future when undertaking a public service duty. We took a pragmatic course that does not require people of caliber to give up too much for the public good. We must not reduce Singapore to another ordinary country in the third world by dodging the issue of competitive ministerial remuneration. They say people can think for themselves. Do you honestly believe that the chap who cannot pass elementary school knows the consequences of his choice when he answers a question viscerally on language, culture, and religion? But we knew the consequences. We would starve. We would have race riots. We would disintegrate. To get good government, you must have good people in charge of government. I have observed in the last 40 years that even with a poor system of government, but with a good, strong people in charge, people get passable government with decent progress. On the other hand, I have seen many ideal systems of government fail. Britain and France between them wrote over 80 constitutions for their different colonies. Nothing wrong with the constitution, with the institutions and the checks and the balances. But the societies did not have the leaders who could work those institutions, nor the people who respected those institutions. The leaders who inherited these constitutions were not equal to the job, and their countries failed, and their system collapsed in riots, in coups, and in revolution. If a people have lost faith completely in their democratic institutions because they cannot find people of caliber to run them, however good that system, it perishes. Ultimately, it is the people who run the system who make it come to life. It is essential to rear a generation at the very top of society that has all the qualities needed to lead and give the people the inspiration and the drive to make it succeed. In short, the elite. All those with the potential to blossom forth must do so. That is the spearhead in the society on whom depends the pace of our progress. People in the mass can only govern themselves and obtain their needs either through traditional or through representative leaders. A well-ordered society with a long, unbroken history like Britain or Japan has its national solidarity and its establishment based on the king and the royal family, a religion and the elders of the church, the elite in the ruling parties who alternate in power, the elite in the public service and the armed forces, the elite in commerce, industry, and in the professions. There is no better way to run the country than the best person for the most difficult job.
Is the United States at risk of becoming European?
If you follow the ideological direction of Europe, you are done for. There will always be a tussle within societies, as underachievers want more support, but addressing their needs must be done in a way that does not kill incentive. American and European governments believe that they could always afford to support the poor and the needy, widows, orphans, the old and homeless, disadvantaged minorities, unwed mothers. Their sociologists expounded the theory that hardship and failure were due not to the individual person's character, but to flaws in the economic system. So charity became entitlement, and the stigma of living on charity disappeared. Unfortunately, welfare costs grew faster than the government's ability to raise taxes to pay for it. The political cost of tax increases is high. Governments took the easy way out by borrowing to give higher benefits to the current generation of voters and passing the cost on to the future generation who are not yet voters. This resulted in persistent government budget deficits and high public debt. We would like Singaporeans to emulate this American self-help culture. This culture trait has made Americans great entrepreneurs who have the verve, vitality, and vigor to keep adapting and changing their businesses, and therefore their economy, much better than Europeans or Japanese. If the U.S. becomes more like Europe, with a pretty widespread social security net, payment to the unemployed, Medicare is going to cost them an extra $1.2 trillion in 10 years. I do not know where the money is going to come from. If the U.S. goes that way, it will become a slower economy even after private enterprise has taken over.
What does the U.S. need to do to maintain global primacy?
The 21st century will be a contest for supremacy in the Pacific, because that is where the growth will be. That is where the bulk of the economic strength of the globe will come from. If the U.S. does not hold its ground in the Pacific, it cannot be a world leader. America's core interest requires that it remains the superior power on the Pacific. To give up this position would diminish America's role throughout the world. To hold ground in the Pacific, the U.S. must not let its fiscal deficits come to grief. If they come to grief and there's a run on the dollar for whatever reason, and the bankers and all the hedge funds and everybody come to a conclusion that the U.S. is not going to tackle these deficits, and they begin to move their assets out, that would spell real trouble. America's debt is what worries me most, because it will absolutely strike at the heart of America's global leadership. The U.S. must not let its preoccupation with the Middle East, Iraq, Iran, the Israelis, and oil, allow others, especially China, to overtake its interest in Southeast Asia. The Chinese are not distracted. They are looking for energy everywhere, and they are making friends everywhere, including here.